trying to help with puzzles that he came across in the gameplay. I'm sure he didn't need my help, given that I was 6 years younger, but I really enjoyed the time spent with him. It made enough of an impression that I can still picture myself watching him play Mega Man on some old tube TV. Nowadays, David always wants me to get into one of the online games that he plays so that we can play together, but I don't really have time to get sucked in. And then again, I spent hours playing Zelda all by myself last summer, so I probably could play with Dave. As we write this book, I'm surprised at my automatic negative responses to new things sometimes. Especially since I like to believe that I am open and willing to try new things. Especially since I try to please others so much. Eugene's quest has inspired me, though. I'll definitely make an effort to connect with my family at a deeper level. Luckily, I'm not starting from way behind like he is.
What can you do to promote world peace? Go home and love your family. Mother fucking Teresa.
Spilling the family tea. The night after our excursion at the mall is the grand finale. A large dinner planned for my grandmother's official birthday celebration. Before that, the clan descends upon my apartment for a light lunch and relaxation. Well, less leisure, more frazzled organization on my end, with a couple of thoughtful surprises up my sleeve. I've decided to exempt numbers 1 through 5 from this second exercise of extracting secrets because I'm already intimate enough with them. I'll focus my energies on my relatives from whom I could learn real, intriguing revelations, since none of them has had an opportunity in my many years on this earth to open up to me. As relatives begin to populate my modest apartment, they mingle, fill up their plates with fruit, pastries, and eggs, and pull chairs around the couch in the living room to give the illusion that my grandmother is holding court. This presents a problem. By surrounding her, they've formed a ring, which for tete-a-tetes is practically impenetrable. I need to strategically separate each mark from the flock. But like a watering hole, when there's a bounty of assorted fruit platters, Asians will park their kisses for an interminable amount of time. Then, the first solution springs forth in my mind palace. The cake. I had personally ordered a specialty triple berry birthday monstrosity and had a specific window of time to pick it up. I remember that nosy number 6 had been on my ass about ensuring this was locked and loaded. She dug her own frosting-covered grave, and now is the time to make her lie in it. I ask her to accompany me to retrieve it, and the sheer force of her curiosity to see if I had somehow messed it up took her out of the circle and into my passenger seat. This might be the longest period I've ever been one-on-one with her in my entire life. This realization strikes me as rather somber and irresponsible. How many of my family members have I only been familiarized with through group settings? How easy is it to consider someone flesh and blood and then only come in contact with them at a dinner table once every few years? And then she says, unprompted, "Did you know your grandma's going to come live with me?" A home run out of nowhere. My eyes widen, expression agog. My grandmother has lived here in Los Angeles ever since she immigrated decades ago to the United States. It was everyone's natural assumption that she would never relocate. Without going into much detail, out of respect for her privacy, all I can say is that this wasn't a flip decision. This was an enormous, stunning development, one that affects all of us, and one I had zero inkling about. "Who else knows?" I pry. "Oh, well, your mom, your sisters, your uncles, most everyone, really." Ouch. That stung a bit. "Well, what the hell? Was anyone going to tell me?" She looks me straight in the eye. "You are always so busy and hard to get a hold of. I wasn't sure if you really cared that much." Double ouch. Leave it to number 6 to tell me like it is. In learning the juiciest of secrets, I come away with 2 more shocking truths. By simply being present and engaged with another individual for a dedicated amount of time, I don't have to trick them into telling me something new. They'll instinctively volunteer it. And all this time, even as I've described my family's tumultuous history with intimacy and close-offedness, I might be one of the worst perpetrators of all. We return to my apartment to find that the crew has begun to disperse in preparation for the evening's festivities. By this point, I'm already exhausted. Number 7 is seated nearby, watching me quietly as I clean up. She giggles. I'm saying some of my relatives' broken English in a more direct way. You clean very, not often, I shrug. I don't like cleaning, but I'll do it for you. She glances around my space, which I tried to make look as presentable as possible for their visit. It is more clean than last time. Thanks. You normally very dirty. And she laughs. I laugh too, because this isn't a lie. Well, I've been trying to improve because I'm an adult now. Gotta grow up sometime. She smiles and nods. I step out of myself for a moment, watching our small talk from the outside, and shut off the faucet, dry my hands before placing them on my hips. I have a question, I say. Do you not like that I don't speak Korean? I don't know what came over me in that moment to open what could be a Pandora's box of cultural failures on my part as a Korean-American who isn't fluent in the mother tongue. But I'm suddenly compelled to ask the person in attendance whose English is the least developed. She cocks her head slightly, considering her answer carefully. I think better you speak Korean, like your sister, because many times I don't understand you. I walk over, leaning against the chair diagonal from her. Wait a minute. How much have you not understood when I talk to you in my life? She laughs. Most of it. I'm flabbergasted. Every comment or joke or discussion I've presented to number 7 in more than 30 years could have completely gone over her head, and she never once brought it up or complained. This is now the lowest point in my story. Realizing that someone you know and love has barely understood you for most of your existence is beyond sobering. It made me want to quit the English language altogether. That night, as the coordinator in chief, I had to head to the restaurant at the Intercontinental Hotel downtown first to prepare the night's arrangements. But I also needed to make sure that everything was in place for my big secret that I planned to delight my family with. And by delight, I mean ambush. The photos you would see if you bought the book, with some of the faces obscured, were taken at the hotel before and during my grandma's birthday dinner. If you know anything about elder Asians' relationships to getting their photos taken, you're aware that it's like asking someone to get their soul sucked out of their body by a demon. They absolutely despise it. And any time I've even lifted my phone in a suggestive enough manner, my grandmother will literally duck and dodge out of the way as if the picture were a bullet. Well, my deception this evening had twofold reasoning behind it. We needed photographic evidence for this book, and we had never gotten professional pictures taken as a family before. Kill two birds with one stone, as long as the old Asian birds don't fly away upon immediately seeing a camera lens aimed at them. There, in the comfort of a suite, I snuck in my photographer to create an impromptu setup. And as everyone began to arrive, the creeping understanding of what was about to happen settled like a thick, fearful fog. I, the smug ringmaster, hammered home the inevitable. It's family portrait time, whether you like it or not. To my surprise, some of the older relatives even appeared to be enjoying themselves, as I coached them on how to pose like they're on the cover of Vogue. As distant as I have proven to be a conversationalist, I know my strengths as a partygoer, and I managed to liven up the proceedings like a clown pumping up the crowd at a circus. Even numbers 8 and 9, who have always been on the periphery, flank me with approving pats on the back as we watch my grandma nervously get her solo portrait taken. "Good job, Eugene," number 9 commends. "You'll have to send us the photos when they're done," number 8 agrees. "Ah, I'm glad y'all like this," I heartily admit, my mood lightening. "It's nice to have someone like you to bring this type of energy," number 9 says. The bulb flashes. "Reminds me of my cousins." I perk up, having forgotten that I still had to fulfill the challenge of procuring hot gossip from my targets. "Oh, I've never heard about them." Number 9 was in the family via marriage, so her side was completely unknown to me. Number 8 pipes up. "Oh, yeah, they were in the factory." I grow instantly serious. "Oh, no. They worked in a factory?" My immediate assumption was bleak, as most of my distant relatives were embroiled in some dark, bloody tale that spurred from the war-torn Korean peninsula. Number 9 almost snorts. "No, not that factory. The factory. You know, Andy Warhol?" I blink. "What?" She continues. "Yes, you know, when you see the pictures at the factory, if you see a Korean person, that's probably your relative." She laughs. "They're really crazy like you." I blink again.
"Are you freaking serious?"
This incredible revelation throws me for such a loop that I almost forget. Ned. Fucking Ned. Jesus Christ, I forgot that I have to hug everyone. My night isn't over just yet. My greatest fear has yet to come.
Young and restless. My family didn't just love and support me. They saved me. In 1997, I was diagnosed with clinical depression. Night after night, I would cry myself to sleep, telling my mother through tears that I thought I was worthless, that I had no purpose in life. I was 7 years old. Depression is something that can challenge the strongest of families, the strongest of people, especially when exhibited by a young kid. And the strength they exhibited collectively has meant everything in forming my outlook toward life. It's an insane thing for a kid of that age to experience these feelings and to think that about themselves. But depression doesn't contend with logic. These feelings stemmed from a place of looking at my peers and feeling different. Specifically that they were talented and I wasn't, and that I in turn had nothing to offer to the world. Somehow, I extrapolated this into the future and assumed that not standing out now meant that I would never have a place. This fear and anxiety consumed my every thought. Repeatedly, my parents would enter my room at night, alerted by my wailing. They tried their best to calm me, to tell me that kids don't have to worry about these things. I don't remember much from this time, but I do remember that they were always there. Unfortunately, it wasn't enough. My parents were left terrified that they had failed me, confused on how to help. I hit my lowest point when I admitted to my mother one night that I didn't want to live anymore. My parents remained strong. They got me help via therapy. They supported my passions and they guided me toward happiness. But it wasn't all smooth sailing from that point on. I have memories of lashing out at my parents, especially at my dad. Cursing and screaming and slamming doors. It's something my dad downplays and denies when I've tried to apologize as an adult. Maybe that's for the best. But I remember, and I live with the pain of those memories. Family is there to protect you from your own fears and mistakes, and by downplaying those memories, he's offered me the chance to forget the pain and move on. At a time when I wanted to give up, they worked double to fill my life with joy and structure. Eventually, their positivity won out. And then, 2 years after getting diagnosed with depression, I nearly died in a car accident. Maybe you've noticed the scar I have underneath my neck. It's possible you haven't. Cosmetically, it's about as ideal a placement as you could ever hope for, as far as near-fatal lacerations go. My babysitter was driving, and I had successfully talked my way into sitting in the front seat, despite it being firmly against family rules. I've always been very persuasive. The accident was swift and mostly innocuous, a standard fender bender. Everyone else was fine, but I was too small to be in the front seat. The airbag shot out at the speed of a bullet and thrust the edge of the seatbelt deep into my neck, plunging it mere centimeters from my windpipe. I don't remember the accident, but I remember being put on the phone with my father as the paramedics lifted me from the front seat onto the stretcher and into the ambulance. My dad made it to the emergency room first. Throughout the entire surgery, he sat next to me, holding my hand, remaining strong. I needed a rock, and he was it. He never winced or looked away once. I can't imagine how difficult that was for him. 45 stitches later, he wasn't going anywhere. My mom didn't make it to the hospital until the surgery had ended, trapped in the traffic caused by my accident. I'll always remember the image of her entering the doorway of my hospital room. A blurry figure standing at the foot of my bed and nearing closer. She broke into tears, stricken by grief and simultaneously overcome with the most extreme form of relief. I was held out of school for a few months while I recovered, and once again, they were rock stars, providing me with strength in a time when I was at my weakest, aiding me through nightmares and painkillers. It's not easy to make a recovery enjoyable, but my family did their best. My parents gave up their bed so I could spend my days binging movies and crushing episodes of Judge Judy. My sister gave me her favorite stuffed animal so I'd have someone to protect me from the bad dreams. And she provided live entertainment, dancing at the foot of my bed. It was her turn to play Mr. Pillowhead. When I finally removed my bandages, we noticed my swollen face made me resemble Richard Nixon. It hurt to laugh, but it was nice to have something to smile about. Ups and downs filled my childhood, but I consider myself lucky to no end to have the family I have. They stood by me at my lowest point, but what's more, they were there to offer warmth, humanity, and humor. I don't know who I would be without them, but I know who I am because of them. If my childhood taught me one thing, it's that life is fleeting and precious. Surround yourself with people you love. Don't be afraid to laugh and enjoy every moment of it. I'm thrilled to report that, thanks to their love and guidance, I'm 20 years happy. A Brief History of Trying. Author Henry David Thoreau was once known for his philosophies of self-reliance, solitude, simple living, and independence, which he famously developed while living by himself for 2 years at Walden Pond. What he left out of his book was that he would often dip into town so that his mom could do his fucking laundry.
Hug, monster. For my grandmother's big birthday dinner, we're in a very posh, private room 70 stories above downtown Los Angeles. The polished granite table is huge and circular, almost Arthurian, with my grandmother at the head, a reluctant queen. I knew that I had a limited amount of time to strike on Ned's hugging prompt, and that it would be hopeless to attempt it once the first course had arrived. Cursing his ooey-gooeyness in my head, I decide to embrace our philosophy and just go for it. Go down your list, I encourage myself, knowing that starting easier might garner me the courage to get all the way down to number 10. As everyone holds court, I stand and make my way over to number 1, my little sister. I sheepishly open my arms and, with my voice lowered to a creaky whisper, I croak, "May I have a hug?" She looks me over, eyebrow raised.
"What did you say?"
I shush her. "Shh. Don't draw attention because I don't want the others to know. I have to do this. Just hug me." She stands and obliges. "You used to do this all the time when we were kids. Mainly because I was chubby," she mused as we held on to one another. "Yeah, well, you're not chubby anymore, so it's not as pleasant." We laugh as I release her from my grasp. Number 2, my older sister, had been next to us as this all transpired. She stands up dutifully and wraps me in her arms. "I know this is for your book, so let's get it over with." I sigh. "Don't say that so loud. They're not supposed to know it's for the book." "Well, maybe they'll actually do it then, if they know you'll make money off it. Otherwise, you're going to look like a total weirdo." My older sister and I hold on to each other, a sight for anyone who knew us growing up, since we didn't properly hug until we were both in college. Today, it's not that awful, especially since we still find ways to make it riotous. "Your boobs feel gross," I retort. She lets go of me.
"Thanks, your face is ugly."
Ah, family. Some things never change. I have to traverse the room to approach number 3, my mom. By the time I latch onto her, I know all bets are off for keeping this hug train covert, so I'll need to make this one count. She is, luckily, my easiest and longest hug. "Sorry I don't call enough," I say. She pats me on the back.
"That's okay. I'm just glad we're here."
I can feel that she's smiling. I have to relax my grip to signal for her to let me go. The way she hugs me is as if it's the last time she'll ever get to do it, and I find myself almost getting choked up. Number 4 is sweet and painless, since we've hugged before, but only in passing. Surprisingly, she's tickled pink by the gesture. "You don't mind hugs?" I ask her as we embrace. "No, I actually like them," she says. "Huh, I wouldn't have thought that." She sits back down. "Not liking hugs doesn't make you cooler, Eugene," she declares smartly. I chart a path to number 5, who's standing in a corner embroiled in a discussion, wineglass swirling in hand. For the life of me, I can't recall the last time I actually hugged him. If anything, we've definitely performed the side hug when seeing each other off with the manly double back pat for good measure. Embarrassed, I have to interrupt him in order to propose the question. Can I have a hug? I'm suddenly extremely self-conscious about the whole charade and feel more eyes in the room paying closer attention to my oddball demeanor. He considers my outstretched arms, momentarily perplexed.
Are you leaving?
I shake my head. Nope, just want a hug, I guess. He shrugs and yields. I feel the double back pat since, you know, we've still got to be masculine about it. But then, for several seconds, we hold each other, and he says something, almost at a whisper, so just only I could catch it.
You do good.
Perhaps it was necessitated by the hug, but those three small words, whatever the hell they were supposed to mean, are a gratifying boost of esteem for me. After all, compliments are not readily distributed from all sides of my family, and in ways, my opening up through this try encouraged them to also bounce my challenges back at me in an affirmative way. Now, the hard part, the dreaded numbers 6 through 10. Number 6, eagle-eyed as always, calls me out before I can even reach her.
Whatever you're doing is weird.
I smile. But I can have a hug, right? She snorts.
Sure, but I'm not standing up.
This type of hug I can relate to. Fast, forced, and unusual for all parties involved. When I stand up straight, she slaps me lightly on the arm.
Is this for a video?
I pause.
No.
She squints at me.
Right.
I laugh internally because there's no getting past my relatives when something is amiss. When I turn to number 7, I take a moment to properly ask her for permission and make sure that I come down to her seated level. She authorizes my intimacy, and I envelop her in a strong, substantial hug. I envision that I'm sending her all sorts of positive emotions through my palms, convinced that she must be deriving some sort of long-awaited enjoyment from this. She very quickly pushes away from me with a defiant,
"Okay, that's enough."
I pull away, wondering how I can make her feel that I've taken exceptional care this evening. I gesture toward the cake I ordered, with the Korean word for grandmother, halmoni, written in icing. Do you like the cake I got you? She takes a gander, very clearly noticing the Korean characters. A tiny smile.
Yes, I like. Very much.
Obviously, number 7 is my grandmother. I'll take whatever sign of approval she can spare and stride confidently to numbers 8 and 9, both of whom I have never hugged before, but found the action to be far more straightforward than I could have ever imagined before this birthday weekend. They're both actually quite relaxed huggers, with number 9 ending our clinch with a quippy, "You are too funny." I can't tell if it's a compliment or an insult, but I assume it's our particular brand of both at the same time. Then, I lock my sights on number 10, who, quite literally, recoils as I descend upon him. He is viscerally on edge, relating all too well to this unannounced invasion of personal space. I instead extend an open hand for a shake. He deliberates over it for a few seconds before lifting his arm and presenting a closed fist. Fist bump. I laugh out loud. You can bet your ass I've never even come close to hugging number 10. But I have also never engaged in something as casual and brotherly as a fist bump. I close my hand and connect with him, knuckle to knuckle. I even burst my hand outward with a bomb sound effect. Explosion? He shakes his head. No. And then he returns to his phone. I managed to secure 9 out of 10 hugs and one unforeseen fist bump within the span of the bread course. More hugs achieved in less than half an hour than I had ever experienced with my family members in my entire lifetime. Whatever the intended effect, my affectionate, albeit bizarre expressions of kindness, had impacted every one of my relatives who had a seat at that table. The flow of conversation was open, easygoing, and real. Everyone had a fantastic time. And most important, my grandmother had a fitting 90th birthday. In part due to my once-in-a-lifetime preparedness in marshalling events, but more because, as she later told my mother,
"I was just happy that everyone was there. That's all I needed."
It turns out, it's not just about being there for someone you love, although that is a huge part of the responsibility of maintaining healthy relationships with your friends and family. It's about committing to be truly present, which is a difficult, active mode to switch to when you've been flying on autopilot your entire life. Keith's compliments challenge forced me to gaze beyond the surface assumptions I had of my loved ones and recognize what genuinely matters to them. Too often I've skated by like an acquaintance in my own home, communicating only what I knew to be canonical about our bonds, without much digging deeper. By seeing past our ordinary repartee, I managed to make others feel truly seen and appreciated. Zach's Secrets Challenge provided me not only with information I had never suspected of my relatives, but urgent actualizations about myself and how sometimes, when you're in the dark about others' lives, that responsibility ultimately also falls on you to come into the light. Secretive behavior begets secretive behavior. And if I don't know something that everyone else is aware of, then I need to re-examine the ways in which I communicate. Ned's hugging challenge was what most intimidated me at the advent of this entire try. But in retrospect, it was foolishly uncomplicated. To embrace someone you already consider family is not the insurmountable hurdle I built it up to be. It was breaking down the internal barriers that was actually most difficult. Finally, the fact that I can entrust such a deeply confidential task, growing closer to my relatives, to my best friends is, in and of itself, a monumental try. In the beginning, I had turned my nose up, balking at their suggestions, searching for their devious intent to torture me. By the end, I concluded what is the most painful for me to concede. They were right, and I was wrong. No matter how much pain, distance, or history informs the turbulent relations with your family and friends, know this. As small as these tries may have seemed, they are astronomical in their impact, because these are the relationships you have been conditioned to give up on the fastest, to believe they are a fixed, immovable point in your autobiography. But it's these small, meaningful gestures that made my grandmother's birthday weekend and my try, even with its shortcomings, a massive success. Something as simple as a phone call, like the ones I'm about to make to my family members to check in after saying this sentence, can make you feel closer to them than you ever had allowed yourself to before. When it comes to family, being there and being present are never a given condition, but something you have to work at. In other words, some tries are never finished. What we learned. Keeping in touch is a two-way street. If you find yourself growing apart from a loved one, it may be on you to make the first move. There is no right way to parent. Your parents were just winging it, and if you have kids, you'll end up winging it too. Anyone who raises a tiny human deserves all the credit in the world. As you embark on this journey of trying and failing, remember that no one has your back like family, however you define it. They're here for you. Use them for support and guidance. Most important, never underestimate the power of a hug. Epilogue. You did it. You made it to the end. The first thing we want to say is thank you. We really poured our hearts and souls into this book, and we really appreciate that you listened to the whole thing. We hope that you came away knowing that we don't have all the answers. In fact, no one has all the answers. It's okay to be clueless. I mean, or like the poster children for cluelessness. But embracing what you don't know, what you don't like, what you can't understand, and what you're totally afraid of, that's where the magic happens. Stepping out of your comfort zone, failing, and flailing can be tough. Hell, it can be some of the most difficult things you ever do in your life. But when you come out the other side with the experience of having tried, of facing all your limitations and shortcomings, of falling flat on your ass, that's where the real growth begins. Now you're equipped with the confidence and knowledge and experience that wouldn't have been possible before. And that, friends, is the hidden power of fucking up. About a year has passed since we first attempted the tries in this book. And in that time, we've had a chance to truly consider the impact these attempts have had on our lives. As you know by now, failure is not a one-day thing. It's a lifestyle. So we wanted to take a minute to update you on how we've grown and how we've regressed.
Yo, it's been a crazy few months. Where do I begin? Yesterday I picked up a pair of jeans from the tailor because I had to get the waist taken in a couple inches. I'm now a 32. I have been a 34 waist since high school. That's 14 years since I wore pants this size. My shirts are loose. My suits are loose. It's wild. Now, please note that unlike the videos you see online of amazing fitness and diet results in just 30 days, all of this has been a really incremental process that comes with living my entire life differently. I didn't stick with a 100% vegan lifestyle. I did, however, adjust my diet to be only 15 to 20% meat, and I have really strived to limit my dairy intake. Becky and I make vegan recipes all the time, and we found lots of delicious ways to make all vegetable dishes. And get this, I haven't cooked a piece of meat in my house since I started this try 6 months ago. That's crazy. I've come such a long way. But it definitely wasn't just a dietary overhaul. I've actually been working out 2 to 3 times a week for the past 4 months. Becky and I committed ourselves to waking up at 5 a.m. to take Orange Theory classes at 6. I know. I never thought I would live this way or be that guy. But it does make more sense to work out in the morning. I can still do everything I do in the day, and we just go to bed a little earlier. Are there times when we fuck up and eat poorly? Yeah. Vacation has become a no-rules zone, but we make up for it when we get back home. Do we cancel workout classes the night before because we just aren't feeling up to it? Of course! But when we cancel one, we make sure to make the next one. We like the changes that we see and feel in our bodies. We're slimmer, yes, but really it's about being healthier. You don't even realize how many other little problems in your life actually stem from your diet. By removing dairy, we found that we have fewer pimples. By cutting out meat, my issues with portion control aren't really such a big deal. You can eat plants until you burst and be totally fine the next day. I've always made excuses to avoid these changes in my life, and it was entirely out of fear. I was afraid to give up the tasty foods I loved, but they aren't out of my life. I just eat them less often, which makes me appreciate them more. I was afraid to feel weak in front of others, but now I see myself getting stronger with every workout. I feared this embarrassment, this loss, this change. But now, I'm just so excited to continue forward on my health journey. Actually, it's not a health journey anymore. It's just my life. I've made it a habit. I'm really excited to continue leading this healthier life, and I'm going to look for other ways to keep improving. I do want to add, though, that I didn't nail everything I set out to do in this book. I still don't talk to my family as much as I should. That's been a much harder bridge to cross. But for Christmas, I did book the family a big Airbnb so that all the Habersburgers could share a roof for the holidays. It was 10 people, one dog, and some really good times. And just like with my diet, you gotta start somewhere, or at the very least, try.
Facing my fashion fears was really tough. There were some moments where I felt uncomfortable every second of the day. I still sometimes dread getting dressed in the morning, but I got a lot of positive feedback. I realized that a lot of my fears were actually all in my head. I have started wearing jean jackets so much now to the point where I can't believe that I was ever afraid of them. Even clothes shopping has gotten a little easier. Ariel and I went shopping for her birthday, and it wasn't a totally awful, stressful experience anymore. It was actually kind of exciting. What new pieces might I find that were a little different, but still me? What could I find to push myself a little bit further? I ended up buying a pair of chunky black Cole Haan high-top boots, something that I would have imagined would be too intense for me before my try. There are still days when I don't want to think about getting dressed and end up wearing sweatpants. Like right now, I'm wearing sweatpants right now, and oh boy, does it feel great. But I try to think a little more about what shirt and shoes to pair with my sweatpants. Dare I say that I've tried to pull off athleisure a few times and have fucking nailed it? It feels weird to say fuck. I'm a dad now. Am I allowed to say fuck? I've tried to keep my sections of the book so clean, you know. And now I'm just gratuitously saying fuck for the hell of it? Fuckity fuck fuck. Fuck a fuckity fuck a fuck. Fuck a fuck a my fuck. See? Growth. I'm still a little uncomfortable posing in photos, but I try to remember that it's just clothes. What I wear doesn't define me. I'm still goofy and silly while being smart and having ideas worth listening to. My clothing is just one potential expression of who I am. It's a representation of what I want to project on the outside. Fashion doesn't have to be a burden. It could be an opportunity to showcase the first impression of the man I want to be. As for Wes, he's full-on crawling now, and when he's holding onto my arms, he can even pull himself up to a standing position. He actually said his first words the other day. They were, "Tabu kaka totra," which sounds to me a lot like the hidden power of fucking up. So I think he's telling you to just go for it.
The Try Guys is the best thing that's ever happened to me. Making these videos for the past few years has led me to evolve tremendously as a person. But if I've learned one thing through writing this book, it's that the self is a constant work in progress. We really thought we'd pushed ourselves to the limit, but this book presented challenges deeper than we'd ever attempted before. Maggie and I remain madly in love. Aww. And my commitment to our relationship, to caring for her and caring for us, has proven to yield an important cornerstone of new life habits. I've become a more selfless boyfriend, constantly seeking ways to make her the center of my world. I've filled her life with loving gestures, both big and small. From surprise weekend getaways and taking on remodeling our guest bedroom, with some help from my friends, to more everyday tasks like changing out the ugly light fixture in our living room, easier than I expected, and packing her the occasional go-to snack bag for work. I shifted the focal point of my universe, and with everything I do, I'm making sure she's the center of it. Becoming a better boyfriend really entailed a journey into every chapter. While writing this book, I've experienced some setbacks with the medicine for my inflammatory disease. So I've been fitting in a full physical therapy routine before work. I volunteered to walk and feed our dog every morning to take some stress off Maggie. This routine provides an infusion of energy and good spirits into my mornings. The walk with Bowie serves almost as morning meditation, allowing me to wake up my brain and focus my mind before a busy day. The extra burst of energy allows me to be proactive about cleaning the dishes, tidying up around the house. You know, all the stuff I used to totally despise. Now, instead of staring blankly ahead during my morning commute, I'm alert and awake, so I call my family and friends to catch up. I feel like I'm starting my mornings off right, which makes me more efficient at work, allowing for a work-life balance for probably the first time ever in my life. All this leads back to spending more time and better time with Maggie. Becoming a better boyfriend has really just been a journey of becoming a more fully realized me. I'm not done growing. I don't think I ever will be. But I'm better now than I was when we started writing this book. Just as I imagine, I'll be better a year from today. The journey is bumpy, and it's okay to fuck up along the way, so long as your aim remains true. You've now got the tools to improve, and so do we. So here's to the future, and becoming the most badass, empowered, confident, bizarre, cool, fucked up versions of ourselves. Never stop having fun. Don't be afraid to laugh at yourself. And above all, never stop trying.
I'd be remiss to reflect upon my attempts to grow more intimate with my family without mentioning how utterly resistant and uncomfortable they are with the idea of even being written about in this book. Moving the needle with my family is akin to moving mountains, and I honestly have no clue if I truly affected any change with my bold embrace of fucking up our clan's interpersonal dynamics. However, the fact that I tried to create new inroads of communication with these people whom I know will be in my orbit for the rest of eternity is a testament unto itself, and the greatest lesson I could take from this experience. Many months later, we don't suddenly have a breezy rapport, and a few days of forced social exercises didn't magically bring us closer together. But what I did manage to do was make everyone feel awkward and deeply distressed. Sure, for a few fleeting moments, we held each other in a fresh, radical regard. And that only came about with my decision to shake things up. But we have quickly settled back into our conventional ways. Still, I feel gratified that I was willing and able to challenge the status quo that has kept everyone in my family at arm's distance for years. In other words, I may have lost the war, but I did win a battle or two. I will probably never become best buddies with number 10, who would only give me a fist bump. In fact, he might like me less after my Grand Inquisition. But he knows me better than he ever has before, and I've clearly tested his limitations. This is light years beyond where I stood with him prior to this endeavor. Now, we're not necessarily friends, but we're no longer complete strangers. Having Keith, Ned, and Zach guide my family try was an impactful experience as well. After trusting their advice, I learned that when it comes to who you end up calling your friends, there are no random accidents. We were meant to be best friends, and I am dedicating myself to keeping it that way. So many friend groups fall along the wayside as you grow older, and social circles morph and absorb and split themselves like amoeba. You and your friends owe it to yourselves to check in with one another and ensure that you not only have each other's backs, but that you can tell each other plain truths face to face. And sometimes test preconceived roles and notions. I followed Keith, Ned, and Zach's advice, something I don't do lightly, and emerged a more fully realized individual and friend because of it.
Remember the beginning of this book, when we were stranded on that raft for hours with my vomit chum just attracting sharks? At the time, it was absolutely terrifying and gross. But when we look back at it now, it was one of the best days in Try Guys history. Because we might have been miserable and scared, but at least we were together, as a family. And now we'd like to welcome you to the Try Guys family. Join us as the adventures continue, and know that we'll always have your back. Things seem impossible, but look around you. There's so many people doing so many different things. Why not try it out? See if you can improve yourself. Here's the thing. You can.
The ball is in your court. It's time to ask yourself the question, what are you going to try? You have the tools, you have the willpower, and you've got four best friends in us who can't wait to hear how it goes. Remember, since failure is the goal, it's basically impossible to mess this up. You're going in knowing it's not gonna go well. So pick something scary or crazy or fun. You got this. We promise.
As much as it pains us to say this, it's time to put down this audio recording. We know there's something in the back of your head that you've just been itching to try. That's it. That's the one.
Thank you for coming on this journey with us four fuck-ups. And welcome to the club.
That's me sipping tea to keep my voice nice and silky. Try Guys Try, recording an audiobook. Welcome to the Try Guys audiobook. It's the Try Guys audiobook. It's the hidden power of fucking up. This is the intro song.
Hi, I'm Bruce.
You know you need unique New York.
I think uniquely hard to say.
To sit in solemn silence on a dull, dark dock in a pestilential prison with a lifelong lock.
Oh, I remember that.
A short, sharp shock from a cheap and chippy chopper on a big black block.
I didn't know that one.
Give it to a short, sharp shock, a big black block.
Yeah.
Repeat after me. One duck.
One duck.
Two chickens. Three squawking geese. Four corpulent porpoises. Five pairs of Don Oliverzo's tweezers.
Oliverzo's or Oliveros?
Red leather, yellow leather.
It's
just two different types of leather.
Chapter 1. Our philosophy. And why Yoda is bullshit.
This is going to be such a long day with all of us in here together.
Bullshit is Cooper Fish.
Oh, I get it.
Philosophy.
You said it like Yoda.
Chapter 1.
No, don't laugh.
Zero embellishment.
Chapter 1. Our philosophy. And why Yoda is bullshit.
Fuck you, Yoda.
Yeah.
What now, little green bitch?
Oh, wow. All right.
I don't know how I feel about
fighting
that.
Words.
We had to try. The waves were much higher and far more frightening than they were supposed to be. A storm.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Sorry. One second. Sorry.
Oh, your thing.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
The storm was brewing.
Oh, my God. I need a moment.
Oh, no. I was trying to create some sound effects for the storm.
Oh.
Hey, what's all this commotion about?
That's what they said, yeah.
Yeah. I'm Bruce.
Don't. Again, that's someone else's character.
Sorry, that's Pixar. Hey, what's all the commotion about up here?
Oh, sorry, Mr. Troy.
We're going to fuck upwards. Sounds better when Eugene says it.
We're going to fuck upwards.
Okay, well, I take it back. I take it back.
I mean, because I kind of like
different
it.
Kind of
different
good.
Kind of good.
Mm, yeah, we're going to fuck upwards.
Oh, God.
Now it sounds like there's someone named Upwards who were all... Anyway.
Oh.
Upwards is so hot right now.
Oh, my arm! My leg! Ah, my body!
Wow, he's dead and dismembered.
Yeah, super dismembered.
Yeah.
I love that.
That's really? Nice lady.
Yeah. That's perfect.
That's Mary Poppins' voice.
Yeah, that's Mary Poppins' voice.
Okay. Guys, buy the Try Guys audiobook, and you too can get Ned doing a Mary Poppins impression. You're going to not want to miss this.
Just a spoonful of sugar at tryguys.com/book. Allotting a fixed maximum unit of time for a plea plan.
Mary, you're just discombobulated.
Mary!
Mary, come back!
For a plea planned activity,
What did you do with that? Why did you do that?
Let's keep going.
Keith, did you actually have a good time?
Okay, all right. 10:15 p.m.
Fuck yeah, boy.
Too sexy.
Too sexy. Fuck yeah, boy. I need it.
Yeah! My scarf.
The Grinch.
My scarf.
The Grinch. The Eugene. So get at it, wives and husbands. At each other's wives and husbands. What a funny place for that to be after I'm talking about the sanctity of my friends' relationships.
Burps. Got burps. Burps coming up.
They gave me a clicker to dispense... Ah, damn. Clothes. Bitter tea time. I'm ready. After consulting with an expert, each day for a week, I'm going to wear an outfit that includes several elephants. Not elephants. The outfits don't include elephants, you guys. So silly. Those would be silly clothes to wear. When you're picking up an utide, septum piercing fake. Oh, right. It's so small in this photo, but I have a septum piercing. The ranch is the best part.
Well, hot dicks.
The only idea I had was to volley between the wonderful, bizarre, satisfying, life-changing, but I thought you nailed it.
Yeah, he did a great job.
Yeah, thank you.
That's great.
Oh my God, you guys. Wow.
Is that it?
Yeah, he's like, get out.
Did we do it?
That's an audiobook. Guys, that's like almost basically the last thing we have to do for this book.
Wow.
I think, except for all the PR emails that I'll have to do for the next week.
So we all have to do.
It's done. We can't do anything to change it.
Audiobook is done.
Woo.
Doctor?
No, author.
Oh, okay, you'll do that again?
Author?
Author.
Yes.
Author.
He is not an author.
I wrote the book.
This is the Try Guys.
Keith Habersberger.
Ned Fulmer.
Zachary Kornfeld.
And Eugene Lee Yang.
This production of The Hidden Power of Fucking Up,
presented by Day Street Books and Harper Audio,
was directed by John Runette
and recorded at Dave and Dave Recording Studios in Burbank, California.
Engineered by Chris Whita.
It was produced by Common Mode.
Paul Fowley, Technical Director.
Okay, Paul.
Executive Producer, Caitlin Gehring.
You go, Caitlin.
Text copyright 2019 by Second Try LLC.
Woo! Production copyright 2019 by HarperCollins Publishers.
All rights are reserved!
Thank you for listening.
Bye!
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.